We'll take your Bibles and turn to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. We're going to begin our study tonight with the verse we're going to end with. But it shows the value of what we're doing this evening. 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. If you look in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 27, you'll see this closing admonition in this letter. He said, I adjure you by the Lord to have this letter read to all the brethren. And so here was a letter written to the church of the Thessalonians. It was designed to be read to them. Of course, they didn't have printing presses, copiers, those kind of things. And so the letters had to be read to the brethren. That's what these letters are designed for. We just sang about the Paradise Valley. Jesus Christ came and died for our sins. We took a memorial for that both this morning and this evening. And then that gospel was preached throughout the world. That's the book of Acts. But now these new Christians needed instruction. They needed encouragement. They needed warning so that they can be able to live the life to be able to enjoy that Paradise Valley. And so you have the rest of the New Testament letters written to churches and Christians for that very purpose. But in order to accomplish their end, they must be read. As with any letter, however, if we're going to get the benefit of a letter, it's helpful to understand not only the overall scope of the letter, but the various divisions of the letter. Sometimes when people read the Bible, they just open to some place in a letter and start reading there, read a verse here, maybe tomorrow read a chapter somewhere else or a few verses somewhere else. We'll never really be able to grasp the train of thought that the author was working on to help the people who he's writing to get to heaven. And thus the benefit of understanding a book in an overall view. A few lessons ago, we began that very thing with 1 Corinthians. And we looked at the first seven chapters in 1 Corinthians. And we looked at them in a very bird's eye type view as we went through the book to try to capture the thought of the various sections. And what we learned, for example, with the first four chapters form a section. That's very helpful in interpretation. And then we see that chapter 5 introduced another subject, but it seemed to be resumed in the middle part of chapter 6. And understanding that helps with interpretation of the first part of chapter 6. All of that may be a little foggy to you right now, but nevertheless, those kind of things are very helpful. As we move into this new section that we're studying tonight, it's helpful, for example, to understand that chapters 8 through 10 form a unit. And when we understand they form a unit, it helps in understanding the writer's thought and in our interpretation of this section. Now, different people may label this in different way. I put down, put the spiritual good of others before self, and hopefully you'll see with the verses I selected out of that section why we've done that. And if in your study of the Bible, or you're going to teach a Bible class, if you can read a section and try to capture the verses that capture the theme of that section, it will be a tremendously good spiritual exercise. And so hopefully this will help challenge us to do that very thing and better to appreciate this particular book. Let's look at some of these verses. Let's start in chapter 8, 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And look at verse 7. Unless the chapter is very familiar to you, you will have to go back and read it to verify that we're taking a verse that captures the idea. But hopefully, either you're familiar with it or you can read it yourself to verify that that's the case. I want you to note in verse 7, and this is a takeoff of what he said in some previous verses, but note he said, however, not all men have this knowledge. What knowledge? And that's real helpful to know what's in the first part of the chapter because Corinth was a city of idolaters. Many of these Christians at the time the letter was written had been idolaters in the past. If you've been an idolater and your daddy was an idolater and your granddaddy was an idolater and now you become a Christian, you understand the truth of Christianity. It doesn't mean there's not some hangover from the past. And while people understood the one true God that Paul preached, Jesus as the Son of God, there was still a problem with some of the people about other gods, not that they worship them. And he deals with that in the first part of the chapter. And that's what he means by when he says, however, not all men have this clear knowledge that there's one God and all other gods are nothing. You think every Christian understands that. Not all of them did. So what do you do? Do you just mark them up as a bunch of dummies and they hadn't grown and ignore them? No, you do not. You consider where they're at and you react accordingly. Look, he says, but some, being accustomed to the idol until now, eat food as if it were sacrificed to an idol. Some in the congregation said, I can eat that meat. That meat had been offered to an idol and now it was sold in the marketplace. They said, it doesn't bother me a bit. There's no such thing as an idol. But not everybody was as clear about that. And so they can't eat that meat. So what do? He said, their conscience is defiled. So what he warned them is, you must adjust your conduct in such a manner as to take into consideration their particular situation. In fact, at the end of the chapter, he makes that famous statement. He said, I won't eat meat again. I'll never eat meat again if it'll cause my brother to stumble. Cause him to lose his soul, in other words. Not, he just doesn't like it. But if it's going to tempt my brother to participate in something that violates his conscience relative to idolatry, well, then I won't eat meat. This is the attitude in chapter 8 and that pervades through chapter 9. Chapter 9 has to do with, we often use chapter 9 to talk about preacher support. And he does talk about preacher support in the first part of chapter 9. There's no question about that. But that's not really the theme. It's not preacher support. The theme is putting the spiritual good of others first. And what he said when you get to chapter 9, he argues his right of support by the Corinthian church, but he wouldn't take their support. And then in chapter 9, verse 19, he said, though I'm free from all men, I've made myself a slave to all that I may win the more. There were particular circumstances at Corinth. He said, I'm not going to let you support me. And then he went on to explain, as you continue to read in verse 20 following, to the Jews I become a Jew, to the Greeks a Greek, etc. In other words, Paul would make an adjustment. It didn't mean he compromised his morals. It doesn't mean he compromised his faith. He would not do that. But in matters of liberty, and sometimes that's the way this section is entitled, matters of liberty. In matters of liberty, Paul would sacrifice his personal choices for the sake of people's spiritual welfare. What a basic lesson for us today. There are churches that cannot get along. They have internal turmoil because people aren't willing to learn this very lesson. To sacrifice personal choices, it may be in the way we dress when we come to the assembly. There have been churches that have a big fuss about how somebody's dressed behind the table. And there ought to be a sense of decorum based on the people that are there. You do things because of the people you work with and worship with. And Paul said, I will make adjustments if it means the spiritual welfare of others. That's really what chapter 9 is all about. And so his aim is to win people. Now, this situation with idolatry, since there were people in the Corinthian church that knew there was no such thing as an idol and prided themselves evidently on the advancement of knowledge they had. The problem is with knowledge sometimes it gets us in trouble. And they thought since they knew there was no such thing as an idol, they could go sit down in the idol's temple at the idol's table and eat that meat being offered to an idol. And Paul said, no, you can't do that. Because when you sit down in the idol's temple at the idol's table under those circumstances, you're participating in the idolatry. So in chapter 10, verse 14, he says, therefore, my beloved, flee from idolatry. And he used the example of Israel. When a man brought an offering to the altar, he was in effect saying, I believe in the God of the altar. And he used the example of the Lord's Supper. His point was not the Lord's Supper. But what his point was, when a person takes of that unleavened bread and that fruit of the vine, they're confessing their faith in the death of Jesus Christ. And if they didn't do that, they partook unworthily. In Levi's prayer, he prayed that we might partake worthily. And so that's what it's designed to do. And so if somebody in this audience, at this time, in this place, ate that piece of bread, they're saying, I believe in Jesus. Now in their heart, they can say, I don't believe in Jesus, I don't believe in Jesus, I don't. But they're saying to me, they believe. And that's Paul's point. He says, flee from idolatry. So knowledge can get us into trouble. Then back to this theme of what's good for others in this last section. Look at chapter 10, verse 24. Let no one seek his own, but that of his neighbor. You notice I left the word good out. It's in italics. It's not there. It's fine. It's nothing wrong with adding that. But the idea is, instead of seeking what I want and what maybe I know is okay, I've got to consider how it impacts other people. It's interesting that the man that's writing this is the same man that wrote in Galatians chapter 1, if I were seeking to please men, I wouldn't be a servant of Christ. He wasn't interested in pleasing people in Galatians 1. But here for three chapters, he's arguing, I do try to please people. How can that be? Liberty. Matters of liberty. When it came to the gospel of Christ, he had nothing to back up, nothing to apologize for. Galatians chapter 1. I'm not interested in pleasing the Jews by trying to teach a gospel of Christ that includes circumcision. I won't do that, he said. But when it came to things that really didn't matter, if it had to do with building up brethren, encouraging brethren, and furthering the spiritual welfare of people, what a great lesson needed even today. Verse 31 through 33 is a principle to live by, not only relative to these people and the eating of meats offered to idols, it's a principle that ought to affect every part of our lives. Look, he said, whether then you eat or drink, and he made the application, look, whatever you do, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. Give no offense either to the Jews or the Greeks or the church of God. Just as I also please all men in all things. Now see, there's Galatians 1. I don't try to please anybody. Here he says, I try to please everybody. How can that be? No conflict when you understand the setting of this particular section of the letter. I please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of many. Look at that last phrase. There's the bottom line right there. And that's why in Galatians 1, he said, I won't try to please men. Because if you change the gospel, you're not going to save them. But what he's doing here is for their salvation, so that they may be saved. And so do not confuse those two ideas. And this statement in verse 31, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. If that principle governed our lives in every decision, you take a job. Okay? Is it right or wrong? Just read this verse. By me working this job, will it glorify God or will it give it cause of offense and reproach to the name of God? In your marriage, at home, how you treat your mate, how you interact with your mate, will this give glory to God or will it give reason of offense and reproach to the name of God? Whatever it may be, it's a principle to live by because you're interested in your life and how it does impact others. Well, that's chapters 8, 9, and 10. Okay, let's look at chapter 11. Now, interestingly, while chapters 8, 9, and 10 form a unit, chapter 11 has two sections in the one chapter. And so you can't necessarily, when you're outlining Corinthians, do it by chapter because here we have a chapter that actually has two different sections. And so you have the first 16 verses. Sometimes this section is called the section on the covering. And it is a section about a covering. You'll see in verse 4, every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. Every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head. And so it is about whether men wear something on their head when they pray or prophesy and whether women do or not. But there's an underlying concept behind that. And he introduces that in verse 3. It has to do with authority. He said, I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man. The head of the man is the woman. God is the head of Christ. And then you'll see that he alludes to it down in verse 10. The woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Whatever that verse may mean, you see that whatever he's talking about has something to do with the concept of authority. Now, what does 1 Corinthians 11 teach people to do? Well, there's a difference about that. Right here in this congregation, there's a difference. And if Rod was teaching this lesson, he could teach this section different than I am going to right now. So you can ask him about his views if you want when we're finished. If Rick Ligon was here, he would teach this different than I'm going to tell you what I think he's talking about. We all agree it has something to do with the covering. And I think probably all of us agree that underlying that is a concept about authority. In my understanding, or misunderstanding, whichever the case may be, I think it has to do with customs. And one reason I think that is because of verse 16. Please read verse 16 with me. Now, I've got the New American Standard Version. This is not only a good time to say something about the first 16 verses, but it's a good time to say something about the value of comparing translations. It's a good time to say something about the value of paying attention to your footnotes. This version translates verse 16, "If anyone's inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God." And evidently the translators translate it that way, thinking that what Paul is doing is kind of putting the stamp of apostolic confirmation on what he said. Now, if you want to argue about it, here's the way it is. We have no other practice. This is the pattern. This is the practice by apostolic authority. And that may be. The problem with that is, that isn't what he wrote. Look on the word "other." And if you have the New American, you'll see a footnote. If you're reading the King James or the New King James or the English Standard Version, it doesn't translate it "other." It uses the word "such." Such and "other," I guess, are as opposed in meaning as two words can be. They're 180 degrees opposite one another. What he wrote was, "We have no such practice." And here's what I think he's talking about. That in Corinth, at that time and at that place, and customs varied from city to city and from time to time, the covering was symbolical of authority. But they would say, "Now, Paul, why don't y'all do that over in Ephesus? This letter's written from Ephesus." Here's the answer. Somebody wants to argue with what he's saying about the need to respect customs and what they say. It's something like foot washing. The Bible does not teach Christians to wash feet, and yet it does. It does if that custom is a sign of hospitality. In other words, be hospitable, and if that's the way you express it. At the end of several letters, it says, "Greet one another with a holy kiss." Did you kiss anybody tonight when you came in? The greeting is what's expected. The kiss is a customary way of expressing that greeting. What's demanded is that we respect the chain of authority that's set forth in this chapter and throughout the Bible. God, Christ, man, and then woman. In their society, whether a woman wore a covering at these particular times said something about her regard or disregard for that. But it didn't in Ephesus. He said, "We don't have that custom." And so if anybody wants to argue, here's the reason we don't practice it here. Or they don't practice it here, whichever the case may be. Please understand, not everybody agrees with that, okay? And so, I want to make that deal. But make that note so you'll understand that. I'm speaking my views alone. But whatever you may believe, that is a section in 1 Corinthians 11 for you to study. Okay? Now, the last part of the chapter has to do with something totally different. Where we had three chapters together, 8, 9, and 10, now we've got two topics in 11. So why did the people who put the chapter divisions in the Bible do it this way? I don't know the answer to that. I don't know why. Why did they make 8, 9, and 10 all one section instead of three chapters? Can't answer that. But that's one of the things you deal with when you study the Bible. Okay, now you get to 11:17. "In giving this instruction, I do not praise you because you come together not for the better but for the worse." And now he begins to talk about a problem in their assemblies. And the problem was, this was supposed to be an assembly to observe the Lord's Supper. Verse 20, "When you meet together, it is not to eat the Lord's Supper," is what this version says. The American Standard says, "It's not possible to eat the Lord's Supper," which I like that translation better. They were coming under the pretense of eating the Lord's Supper, but because of the attitude toward one another, it was prohibiting the right attitude toward the Lord. And both attitudes are addressed in this section. In order to observe that memorial properly, there needs to be an attitude that is correct between the people observing it as we assemble together, and there need to be a proper attitude toward the Lord when we partake. Note, if you will, in the text, in verse 22. In verse 22, he said, "What, do you not have houses in which to eat and drink? Or do you despise the church of God and shame those who have nothing?" So here they came together. They were bringing food to fill your stomach. That's not going to fill your stomach very well. But they brought food to fill their stomachs. And there'd be somebody else, I guess, over there that was poor. It was not uncommon in the early churches to have people who were well off and people who were poor. You see that in the book of James. Did they share? No. Imagine if we came together for a meal and somebody brought a big old bucket full of chicken and potato salad and all of that. Another person didn't have anything. And they wouldn't even share a piece of chicken with them. Now, let's sit down and observe the Lord's Supper together. Are they going to be in a good frame of mind for that? Not hardly. And he says, shame on you. Now, what he told them to do about that is found in verse 34. Verse 34, he said, if you're hungry, eat at home. Separate the social, the entertainment, that kind of thing, from the spiritual. But, verse 26, to correct the situation, they definitely needed to correct these attitudes between them. And the attitudes between them here is but a reflection of what you see pervading the whole letter to 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. There was internal division. You see that in chapters 8, 9, and 10. You see that in chapter 6, back when they were either going to court, where that civil court, or taking it to brethren. Their problems should have been taking it to brethren. There was this issue between them. There, and you see it in the first four chapters when some had one guy they followed and some guy had another guy they followed. There was internal division and conflict. But it surfaces here again. And so correcting this doesn't just involve correcting those attitudes, though. It also involves a correct attitude toward the Lord when you partake of that memorial. There's no power in that bread and there's no power in that fruit of the vine. The power in doing this is remembering what it means. And that's what he said in verse 26. In verse 26, he said, as often as you eat the bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he come. You preach the Lord's death. Is that it? That if I don't do this, we don't know the Lord died? No, people know the Lord died. It's your faith in it, your commitment to it. That's the idea. And that's what we should be saying when we partake of that bread and drink of that cup. And so that's what this section is about. Attitudes toward one another and to the Lord that will be conducive to partaking of the Lord's Supper the way God set it up in the first place. Now when we get to chapter 12, we get through another three-chapter section. And sometimes people study chapter 13. You know that chapter 13 is often called the chapter on love. And it is a chapter on love. But chapter 13 really is sandwiched between these other two, and it goes with these other two. And to really appreciate chapter 13, we need to understand its relationship to the chapter before and the chapter after, which has to do with spiritual gifts. And once again, there was this think about me attitude that surfaced in the use of their spiritual gifts instead of thinking about others. And so this was a problem in the church of Corinth. Well, in the 12th chapter, if I had to pick a key verse, maybe this would be it, verse 7. This verse is not only key relative to what he's writing to them to do, but also key to the interpretations that are often made of this chapter and the 14th chapter. Because in our society, you know that there's a great emphasis on what's called the charismatic movement or Pentecostalism, and people having spiritual gifts and all that kind of thing, and come to an assembly where people supposedly speak in tongues and so forth. And look at verse 7. This is an overriding, an underlying, if you want to call it that, principle that not only you find in chapter 12, but you find it in chapter 14 when he talks about using these gifts in an assembly. And he says, to each one is given the manifestation of the Spirit for the common good. What does common mean? For all, belonging to all. So if a fellow had the gift of tongues, it wasn't an evidence, something for him for his personal salvation, simply for his personal upbuilding. That was a gift for all. And so then he makes the application. in chapter 12, first of all, don't be boastful about it. If you have it, you have it because God gave it, and it's for the good of the whole body. The hand's not for the hand. The foot's not for the foot. It's for the body. Use it for the benefit of the body. And then in chapter 14, it makes application to an assembly where these gifts were exercised. If you look at chapter 14 and verse 26, and we'll come back to 13. Look at 14:26. He says, what is the outcome then, brethren? When you assemble, each one has a psalm, has a teaching, has a revelation, has a tongue, has an interpretation. And these are not just, well, I've studied the Bible a lot, and I'm going to try to interpret that. No, these are powers that they had because the Holy Spirit was empowering them to do these things. Note the last part of the verse. Let all things be done for edification. And if you used to read the rest of the chapter, you would know that means so other people understand and are strengthened and built up. Do all for edification. So 12:7 is for the common good, so I can stand up and speak in a language. Isn't that wonderful? The power, Holy Spirit's empowering me. But is it good for everybody else? And if not, he says, sit down and be quiet. It's for the common good. If I had a vocabulary, which I don't, and you know that, to use these big $50 words, it might be impressive, but it would not be for the common good. And so in our preaching, in our Bible class teaching, in our song leading, a song leader may be able to get up here and lead every one of the 700 songs or whatever it is in our book. But there'd be songs he might lead in an assembly like this that wouldn't be for the common good. Because people don't know them, or they can't sing them. There's too many different parts. And so, while we don't have spiritual gifts, this is still a principle. When we say a prayer, why speak up? Because it's for the common good. You can pray by yourself. This is for the common good. And so that idea that was there being applied to the use of spiritual gifts has very practical value for us. Now, go back to the middle chapter. And you'll see in 12:31 the introduction to chapter 13, actually. He said, yet I show you a more excellent way. He said to desire the greatest gifts, but he said, I'm going to show you something better than the greatest gifts. Prophecy is better than tongues, but I'm going to show you something better than that. Better than either one of those. Love. And he tells in three sections of chapter 13 why love is better. He showed in the first three chapters, if you don't have it, you're nothing. You can do everything, but if you don't have love, it doesn't mean anything. But then in chapters 4 through 7, he shows why it's better because it affects how you think about and act toward one another. Tongues won't do that. Prophecy won't do that. Love will. And then, beginning in the 8th verse or the end of the chapter, he shows, let me tell you another reason why love is better than the gifts. All these gifts are going to pass away. They're temporary. But he said, love never fails, verse 8. And then at the end of the chapter, verse 13, he said, now faith, hope, love abide these three, but the greatest of these is love. Now if you take that verse out of context, the greatest of these is love, and people do, right? The greatest thing in the Bible is love. You mean it's greater than faith? Folks, you wouldn't love God without faith. You mean it's greater than hope? You won't persevere without hope. This is not a statement made in a void. This is a statement made in a context of chapters 12 through 13 and how you treat one another. It's love that affects how we treat one another, what I'm going to do with those special gifts that I have. That's why it's the greatest contextually. And so, seeing a book, reading the section, finding out the thread of thought, very valuable. Now, there's an interesting, and I have it here on the chart, 14:37. I want to stress that because we have a society today where gifts are king. Regardless of what the Bible says, I know I can speak in tongues. I've heard speaking in tongues. Look what Paul said in 14:37. He said, if anyone thinks he's a prophet or spiritual. And they did have prophets. And they did have people with spiritual gifts at the time he wrote this. But he said, listen, let him recognize the thing which I write to you are the Lord's commandment. Here's how they are to be used. He indicated in this chapter a tongue speaker can control his tongue speaking. A prophet can control his prophecy and ought to. And women are not to address the assembly like the prophet and tongue speaker do. He indicated that. And then in verse 38, if anyone does not recognize this, he is not recognized. And the King James, New King James say, if anyone is ignorant, let him be ignorant. The point is simply this, however you translate it. If this guy says, I'm a prophet, and I'm going to speak when I have a gift, or I'm a tongue speaker, and the Spirit's in power, and nobody's going to stop me, Paul said, either way you take it here, in verse 38, don't recognize him. Don't recognize him as a prophet. He's ignorant. He's comfortable in his ignorance. Let him be ignorant. Don't be moved by that. What you are moved by, what your rock-solid foundation is that letter is signed by an ambassador of the king. That's the point. This is the Lord's commandment. Okay, let's look at chapter 15 together. Now, chapter 15 stands by itself in the discussion of the topic of the resurrection of the human body. Listen, folks, this seems so obvious, and yet, listen, we have, I guess they're brethren, I don't know. People in churches of Christ, you're saying 1 Corinthians 15 is not talking about the resurrection of the human body. Because you see, if it is talking about the resurrection of the human body, which has not happened yet, then a major theology is immediately struck down. That's called the AD 70 doctrine, which says every prophecy in the Bible had its fulfillment no later than AD 70. What are you going to do with the resurrection of the body then? You got to make this mean something else. I think a casual reader would read chapter 15 and see very clearly that's what he's talking about. First of all, look at the question of the chapter, verse 12. The question is, if Christ has preached that he's been raised from the dead, that is, that his body has been raised from the dead, how do some among you say there is no resurrection of the dead? Now, what did they preach about Christ's resurrection? It was his body that was raised. Then what does the phrase mean in the last part of the verse? How do some say that the body will not be raised? That's the question. Some were questioning the resurrection of the human body. Look at verse 35. Someone will say, how are the dead raised? And with what kind of body do they come? Because I can't explain how, doesn't mean it's not going to happen. How did God make an axe head float on water? How did he flood the earth with water? How did he raise the dead? I don't know. And Paul said, verse 36, to get lost in those questions is foolishness. The fact is, there is a resurrection in the human body. Now, in answer to the questions, look at verse 20. Now Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of them that are asleep. First fruits mean there's others just like it. So his body was raised, others will be raised. Look at verse 51. I tell you a mystery, we will not all sleep, that is die, but we will all be changed. In a moment, in a twinkling of an eye, the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be, dead what? Body. That's the way it is all through the chapter. The dead body will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed, and this perishable must put on imperishable, and this mortal must put on immortality. In other words, there's coming a day, this old body subject to pain and sickness and getting old, subject to cancer and heart attacks and strokes and all of that. A Christian can look forward to the time there'll be none of that. He'll have a new body. So what's it going to look like? I don't know. I know it will be immortal. I know it will be powerful. I know it will be glorified. I'll get the right word here. But it's a fact. It's a promise based on the resurrection of Christ. So what? Verse 58 answers that. Therefore, says so what, doesn't it? Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your toil is not in vain in the Lord. It's interesting, the same writer, when he wrote the second letter to them, in chapter 4, he talked about his own body. And talked about the fact that he was able to persevere in his ministry. And remember, Paul had been beaten. He had some thorn in the flesh. I don't know what other kind of problems he had. Maybe he had an impediment in his speech or poor eyesight. But he said, I'm looking forward to a time when I'm going to enjoy dwelling in this new house not made with hands. He's talking about the new body. And that's why he could persevere in the face of trial and difficulty. And so, it's a great chapter of encouragement, as well as taking away the false teachings that were prevalent there in the Corinthian church. By the way, what would you think if you were part of a congregation where there were people who said, I believe that Jesus is risen from the dead. I believe he's the Son of God. I do not believe the human body be raised. What would you do? Say, I got to go to church somewhere else. Paul didn't tell them to do that. He tried to teach them. You're not going to have a group of people of any number that's going to agree on everything. This is a pretty serious thing here. But you're not going to have people that agree on everything. And not all of them were a state of understanding about this topic or the topic of idols. We talked about chapter 8. Well, let's go to the last chapter of the book. It's kind of a number of topics in this last chapter that we'll look at real quickly. I put the first 9 verses. This could be subdivided, first 4 verses and then 5 through 9, but I just put them all together. He starts out talking about a collection. This collection is not new to these people. We know that from the 2 Corinthian letter. He said they'd been ready for a year past. This letter's probably written in the spring. So for a year past, they'd already known about this collection. What he's essentially telling them is how to be sure to have that money ready when he gets there. He said, I've talked to the churches of Galatia about this. And so he said, on the first day of the week, each one of you is to put aside and save, as he may prosper, that no collection be made when I come. Paul didn't want to arrive at Corinth. He's on his way. He didn't want to get there and then have to start gathering money. They said they wanted to participate. Well, have the money ready when I get there. And so how do you do it? A regular contribution on the first day of the week is what he told them to do. And so that's this particular section of the book. Now, when you get down to 10 through 12, he talks about two men, Timothy. If Timothy comes, see that he's with you without cause to be afraid, for he's doing the Lord's work. Let no one despise him. Send him on his way in peace. And then you have Apollos, verse 12. I encourage him greatly to come to you with the brethren. And so here are these two men that he has a great regard for and encouraging the church to treat them with respect. And Timothy very possibly provide for his needs and expenses. But then in verse 13 and 14 is kind of a summary admonition. Imagine being in the church at Corinth, and you've got the problem of people following men, the first 4 chapters, men who are trying to undermine the Apostle Paul. That's clear from the second letter, but alluded at in this division over men in the first 4 chapters. You've got immorality in your midst. You're trying to battle that. And there's conflicts among brethren because of that, as indicated in the first part of chapter 6. And you've actually got people in the congregation that thinks fornication is okay. That's the last part of chapter 6. And there's all kind of questions about marriage, chapter 7. And then you got this problem with eating meats, chapter 8 through 10. And you think, boy, this is a battle. Don't you get tired? Fighting the battle. You ever get tired of fighting battles? Don't you just wish we could just settle down and all agree on one thing and don't have to continually thrash through stuff and everybody be on the same page? It just doesn't work that way. And so he said, be on the alert And it seems like these are military terms, and you can kind of vision this as a soldier. Be on the alert. Stay on the alert. Keep watching. There's danger. Stand firm in the faith. So when you see danger, don't run, don't back up, stand firm. And then the battle engages. Act like men. The battle engages, stand like a man. And then he said, be strong. As the battle wages on, you may get tired. Be strong. Persevere. And in all this battle, look what he said, that all that you do be done in love. That's a sermon in itself, those two verses. But it's his summary admonition to a church that had all kind of internal problems and turmoil. Maybe sometimes you've been in a place where you've experienced those kind of things. We've been very, very blessed here at Humble. There have been times in the past it's been tumultuous, and who knows what lies around the corner. But here's the admonition that he makes to this group. And then in 19 through 24, so often in his letters, there are some various greetings relative to himself and other brethren. And so, there's the 1 Corinthian letter. What are they to do with it? A carrier brings it, and a carrier did bring it. What are they to do with it? Read it. Read it. And then Paul awaited very anxiously to see what would happen when they read it. And if you want to know what happened when they read it, read 2 Corinthians. Because that letter is written based upon them reading the first letter and responding to it.